Hi, this is Brian, and we are reading The Hill for Tuesday, February 17. The story, civil rights leader Jesse Jackson dies at age 84. Celebrated civil rights leader, the Reverend Jesse Jackson, died early Tuesday, his family said in a statement, after battling the neurodegenerative disorder progressive supranuclear palsy, or PSP. He was 84 years old. Our father was a servant leader, not only to our family, but to the oppressed, the voiceless, and the overlooked around the world, the Jackson family said. We shared him with the world, and in return, the world became part of our extended family, it added. His unwavering belief in justice, equality, and love uplifted millions, and we ask you to honor his memory by continuing the fight for the values he lived by. Rainbow Push Coalition, the civil rights and social justice organization Jackson founded, said in a statement last November that Jackson had been admitted to a hospital under observation for PSP, a rare disorder that he had been managing for over 10 years. PSP impacts certain functions like balance, swallowing, and walking, and there is no cure for the rare neurodegenerative disorder. Symptoms can only be managed. Jackson is survived by his wife Jacqueline Lavinia Brown and their five children, Santita Jackson, former Representative Jesse L. Jackson Jr., Democrat of Illinois, Jonathan Luther Jackson, Yusef Dubois Jackson, Esquire, and Jacqueline Lavinia Jackson, Jr. Jackson became a national icon within the civil rights movement, particularly during the 1960s, when he and seven others who later became known as the Greenville Eight tried to desegregate a public library in protest of racial segregation policies in the South. Considered a protege of the late Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., Jackson helped spearhead the Southern Christian Leadership Conferences, or SCLC, Operation Breadbasket, a program that focused on economically improving the lives of black communities, first in Chicago and later nationally. Jackson was also with King when the civil rights leader was assassinated in 1968. Jackson later created his own social justice group, which later became a merger of two groups, Rainbow Push Coalition, in the mid-1990s. The civil rights leader was also known for his two presidential campaigns. During the 1980s, Jackson ran twice for president, once in 1984, losing to former Vice President Walter Mondale in the Democratic primary, and once more in 1988, losing to Democrat Michael Dukakis in that primary. Jackson later served as one of Washington, D.C.'s shadow senators between 1991 and 1997. In 2000, he was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom. The story, DHS shutdown has no clear off-ramp. Five takeaways. There's no end in sight for the Department of Homeland Security, or DHS, shutdown, as both sides point fingers while seemingly moving no closer to a resolution. The Senate left town on Thursday after Democrats decided against supporting a stopgap spending bill over concerns that talks about the full-year funding measure haven't advanced far enough. They are demanding reforms to immigration enforcement tactics after federal agents shot and killed two U.S. citizens in Minneapolis amid enhanced operations in the city. DHS funding lapsed on Saturday, leaving much of the department, particularly the agencies, not involved in border efforts, working without pay. Here are five takeaways as the shutdown drags on. There's no end in sight. Negotiators are showing few signs of backing down from their demands, and there's little holding back talks from dragging on for the foreseeable future. The White House and top Democrats have traded proposals and counteroffers for a week and a half, while lawmakers indicated late last week that the two sides have made some headway. It wasn't enough for Senate Majority Leader John Thune, Republican of South Dakota, to cancel this week's recess. The nearly a dozen demands for reforms to immigration enforcement that Democrats unveiled weeks ago were headlined by calls to tighten warrant requirements, unmask agents engaging in field operations, and end roving patrols. As of late Monday afternoon, Democratic negotiators had yet to respond with a counteroffer to the White House's proposal from late last week, which Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York, deemed not serious. Despite Schumer's declaration, Republicans have insisted that the White House is not only negotiating in good faith, but has made its fair share of concessions. They've offered a lot. Despite Schumer's declaration, Republicans have insisted that the White House is not only negotiating in good faith, but has made its fair share of concessions. They've offered a lot, and at some point, Democrats have to show that they're trying to pass an appropriations bill, or whatever this is about November for them, one senior Senate GOP aide said. It appears highly unlikely that talks will reach a stage that prompts lawmakers to be called back to Washington this week. Thune told reporters last week that members could be hauled back in as little as 24 hours if needed. Absent an agreement, they will return to Washington next week. And any deal might take a while to strike. There are myriad reasons why an accord doesn't appear imminent. Democrats are under immense pressure from their base not to strike a deal that directs any additional money to Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, or Customs and Border Protection, or CBP, without significant reforms, or at all, after a Border Patrol agent shot and killed ICU nurse Alex Preddy in Minneapolis last week. At the same time, Schumer over the past year has found himself on the back foot with progressives, who are the loudest voices, urging him to stick to his guns and is eager not to upset his left flank. Republicans, meanwhile, are not feeling the heat enough to give in on what they view as big asks of Democrats. The DHS shutdown has little effect on ICE because the GOP greenlit billions in funding for the agency and for border security writ large in its big, beautiful bill, meaning that despite a funding lapse, deportations will continue, and while funding has lapsed for other agencies, a vast majority of DHS employees are considered essential, which means they will continue running operations, even if they're doing so without pay. Republicans also believe they've extended themselves pretty far in talks, having already agreed to a bipartisan DHS deal that included compromises and funding increases for body cameras and de-escalation measures, among other reforms. In their view, they already met Democrats halfway on a series of items the minority party now wants to put back on the table, and absent any deal, there are few guardrails on ICE. Right now, ICE is operating on no imposed constraints by Congress, the GOP aide continued. I don't know why Democrats would want that to continue on, because what we've offered is far better than what the status quo is. Democrats, however, are casting their demands as common sense and betting that the discontent with immigration operations that started to show up in recent polling will continue. These are common sense proposals, Schumer told CNN on Sunday, referring to unmasking and having every ICE and CBP wear a body camera. They're supported by the American people. Why won't Republicans go for them? They don't give any good answers. It's something that every police department does across the country, but ICE is rogue out of control. Americans unlikely to feel shutdown pain immediately. Perhaps the biggest reason for the impasse dragging on is that, unlike a full government closure, it will not hit nearly as hard for millions of Americans. Congress has already passed 11 of the 12 full-year funding bills for fiscal year 2026. Unlike in past lengthy shutdowns, air traffic controllers, a group that has played a role in ending past lapses, are funded. So is the Department of Defense, meaning service members will be paid, and Department of Agriculture, which means payments under the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, will go out. Similarly, despite the lack of DHS funding at present, roughly 90% of the department's 260,000 employees are deemed essential during a shutdown, meaning there will be little interruption to services. This is the case at the Transportation Security Administration, or TSA, where 95% of the employees are considered essential. Nevertheless, the historic fall shutdown created major impacts for travelers that outside groups and lawmakers are hoping to avoid only months later, especially with spring break on the horizon. The possibility of TSA workers getting caught in the crossfire only heightens those fears. Funding uncertainties create lasting damage to the entire travel ecosystem, especially the airlines, hotels, and thousands of small businesses the travel industry supports. Three key industry groups, U.S. Travel, Airlines for America, and the American Hotel Association, said in a statement. They also noted that the shutdown last year resulted in an economic impact of $6 billion, nearly $140 million per day, and disrupted travel for more than 6 million travelers. Paycheck pressure point. One potentially key date to watch is February 27, as that is when DHS employees are scheduled to get paid next. On top of TSA workers, a missed paycheck would also affect employees at the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, Coast Guard, and the Secret Service, among others, and at a time when some are still picking up the pieces from the fall shutdown that resulted in missed paychecks and was only resolved 3 months ago. Fortunately for them, back pay is guaranteed, but that will do little to assuage them in the meantime. Many TSA officers work paycheck to paycheck, trying to support themselves and their families, Ha Win McNeil, the acting TSA administrator, told the House Appropriations Subcommittee on Homeland Security last week. During a shutdown, the ability to pay for rent, bills, groceries, childcare, and gas just to get to work became very challenging, leading to increased unscheduled absences as a shutdown progresses. The possibility of TSA workers missing paychecks could have the biggest impact of all, especially if they begin calling in sick, as air traffic controllers have in past shutdowns. That would create major headaches and cause even more travel disruptions than occur. McNeil noted that higher callouts among TSA workers has a cascading negative impact on the economy. Probes slow to a crawl. One major impact of a shutdown, of the shutdown, is expected to hit the DHS's Inspector General, as a lapse in funding will affect scores of investigations that are ongoing. With those expected to grind to a halt until a deal is in place and funding is restored, the Inspector General's office told Politico that roughly 85% of audits, evaluations, and inspections that are currently in progress will be suspended due to the shutdown. Included in those are 8 investigations into the administration's deportations efforts that range from claims of excessive force by agents and facial recognition use, according to the report. This raises major questions over whether there will be proper oversight of the key department as Democrats continue to cry foul over their actions in the field. Adding to the tumult is that a significant portion of the Inspector General's office will likely shutter. More than 60% of the OIG's employees were furloughed during the fall shutdown. Democrats have been worried that DHS Secretary Kristi Noem will try to quash most of its ongoing probes, with DHS General Counsel James Percival admitting that the secretary requested a list of all ongoing probes by the OIG. Noem has the right to ask for a list of ongoing investigations and to terminate them if she chooses to, which has dismayed the minority party. I am frankly shocked that instead of simply denying that the secretary is seeking to intimidate an independent government watchdog out of investigating potential crimes committed by DHS agents, it appears her brown-nosing general counsel is proud of his efforts to sabotage IG independence on behalf of Secretary Noem, and is baselessly accusing Donald Trump's own handpicked IG of engaging in illegal conduct. Senator Tammy Duckworth, Democrat of Illinois, recently said, "This response is truly bizarre and deeply troubling. notably the initial bipartisan DHS funding deal for fiscal 2026, included increased funding for the OIG. The story, Why Violent Crime is Dropping in U.S. Cities. Violent crime fell dramatically in 2025, in what experts expect to be the year with the sharpest drop in homicides in recorded history. The decline detailed in two recent reports of major U.S. cities follows a trend that began in 2022 after the COVID-19 pandemic saw a record-breaking spike in homicides. This is the fourth year in a row of declines, and each year has gotten a little bigger than the year before, and this is the first time that we've seen it in all of the categories. I think seven of the eight categories fell by close to a record amount, John Roman, director of the Center on Public Safety and Justice at NORC at the University of Chicago, said in an interview Monday, referring to the eight major crime categories that the FBI tracks. So this is a unique and historic decline in crime and violence in the U.S., he continued. The FBI has not yet published its official crime statistics for 2025, but the findings are expected to align with recent reports from the Major Cities Chiefs Associations, or MCCA, Violent Crime Survey, released earlier this month, and the Council on Criminal Justices, or CCJ, Year-End Crime Update, released late January. The MCCA survey, including data from 67 of 68 responding agencies, shows from 2024 to 2025, homicide is down 19.3%, rape is down 8.8%, robbery is down 19.8%, and aggravated assault is down 9.7%. The CCJ report, which includes data from 40 large American cities, though not every city reports data for every crime, shows from 2024 to 2025, homicides dropped by 21%, robbery decreased by 23%, and aggravated assault declined by 9%. CCJ tracks rape and other forms of sexual assault in the same category, which did not report any significant changes in 2025 from the previous year. It's difficult to pinpoint a single reason for the decline in crime over the past few years, but members of the Trump administration often tout President Trump's aggressive approach to crime and immigration. His supporters also point to his tough rhetoric as a deterrent to would-be criminals. FBI Director Kash Patel responded to coverage last month of the 2025 CCJ report, suggesting Trump and the historic results of this FBI deserve credit for the historic drop in homicides. Nearly 200% more arrests, violent gangs crushed, fugitives hunted down, Patel wrote in a post on the social platform X in late January. Media gymnastics can't hide the reality that this administration brought law and order back, and Americans are safer because of it. Many experts, however, say the primary driver of plummeting crime rates is the sharp increase in crime in 2020 and 2021. The number one reason why crime is falling now is because it was sort of artificially high because of COVID. COVID had all kinds of consequences that led to there being more violence, Roman said. He also suggested that funding for states and local governments from the American Rescue Plan Act, or ARPA, helped communities recover from steep losses in the pandemic, including by funding teachers' roles, counselors, and more police officers in communities. While specific programs in local communities might have been effective at reducing crime, Roman noted that the drop in crime is a national trend that must have a broader explanation. If you look at the top 25 biggest cities in the U.S., all but maybe one or two have seen big declines, and the ARPA money went everywhere. It didn't go to specific programs. It wasn't like if you have this specific program, you get the money, and if you don't have it, you don't. Everybody got the money, he said. And that's really the key clue as to why it probably is those funds that explain the decline. Roman said the ARPA funding is the only explanation in recent years that was universal. Every other explanation that I hear is specific to one place or one program and doesn't explain why crime and violence is declining massively everywhere, he said. Some point to the investments in community violence intervention programs as successful, but others say it's difficult to prove the effectiveness of those programs and the evidence has been mixed in their results. Emily Owens, a professor of criminology and economics at the University of California, Irvine, agreed that the national trend suggests a larger reason. The consistency of the homicide decline, both across cities and over time, makes me inclined to think this has to do with larger social movements temporarily disrupted by COVID-19 when the world turned upside down than with any one particular thing one particular city might be doing, Owens said in an analysis of the data. White House spokesperson Abigail Jackson pushed back on suggestions that ARPA funding contributed to crime drop. The legislation, which included $350 billion for state and local governments, was signed by President Biden in 2021. This is a claim so absurd that it would make even the most partisan Democrat flack blush. Joe Biden's soft-on-crime policies made communities less safe, Jackson said. President Trump has secured the border, deported violent criminal illegals, and empowered law enforcement to do their jobs. Crime is dropping because of President Trump's law and order policies. Any suggestion otherwise is simply not based in reality, she continued. The story, Democratic candidates rush to define themselves ahead of primary season. The 2028 Democratic primary may be a year off, but many of the would-be candidates have already begun to soft launch with voters. Potential candidates such as Governors Gavin Newsom of California and Josh Shapiro of Pennsylvania are turning to newly penned books and late-night appearances. Kamala Harris, the former vice president turned 2024 Democratic nominee, conducted a months-long book tour and is making her way through a string of Rust Belt and red states before she wraps up in April. Others, including Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear, former Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg, and Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker, are using podcasts, festival stages, and high-profile interviews to tell their stories and to make the case for why they should be their party's next standard-bearer. In It's the Wild, Wild West Out There, Democratic strategist Rodell Molyneux said, there's no leader of the Democratic Party, a lot of noise out there, and a lot of clutter, so defining yourself is a smart thing. You can't manufacture authenticity, so these candidates need to make sure whatever they're doing is real, Molyneux said. Voters can smell BS, so putting yourself out there means doing it in an authentic way. Newsom, widely seen as the early frontrunner, will next week release his new memoir, Young Man in a Hurry, a memoir of discovery, a book the New York Times called one of the most anticipated of the year. In the lead-up to the book launch, Newsom and his family were featured in a Vogue spread where they were photographed by Annie Leibovitz. In the book, the California governor details his undiagnosed dyslexia and writes about the dichotomy of his parents' divorce and how he shuffled between life with his mom, who worked three jobs to support her children, and life with his father, who moved in the Getty family's social circle and was surrounded by wealth. Newsom, whose aides have been planning the book launch for months, is expected to saturate the media ecosystem with interviews and campaign-style stops in places he'll need to win to gain his party's nomination, including South Carolina and New Hampshire. He is expected to launch his book in Nashville, Tennessee, a red state, and will also travel to Atlanta. Newsom's book launch comes a month after Shapiro rolled out his book, Where We Keep the Light, Stories from a Life of Service, which leaned heavily into how Shapiro wants to present himself as a suburban dad, an observant Jew, and a problem solver. To promote the book, Shapiro sat for a long interview with CBS News' Sunday Morning, speaking about everything from his upbringing to his thoughts on the campus protests that spread around the country in response to the war in Gaza. The governor also appeared on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert last month, where he discussed the love letter he wrote in college to his now wife and how he found out later that she did a dramatic reading of it with her friends. A few months ago, I went to her 30th college reunion, and they were recounting passages from that letter that they still remember, Shapiro recalled. But I got the girl at the end of the day, and we've been married for 28 years. Late night continues to be a popular way to drive a personal narrative. An appearance on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart last week, Bashir playfully dodged the question about which of the governors who are thinking about running for the Democratic nomination would be the best president. He looked at the audience and didn't say a word. At one point, Bashir even turned the question to Stewart, "Are you doing it?" Many Democrats say they are happy to see an early primary playing out, with candidates making the case even before the midterm elections have taken place. "I have for a long time thought that this primary should start as soon as possible, for many reasons," Democratic strategist Joel Payne said. "There's a desire and an eagerness for leaders to step in and step up. I think the primary process is a good opportunity to do that as an experiment for the party. You're going to see people add dimension to their personas," Payne added. "In order to be a real national figure, you have to have the time to develop that persona. And as Payne warned, there's a higher risk to being irrelevant than being overexposed." Buttigieg in recent months has appeared everywhere from GQ, where he talked about masculinity and raising boy-girl twins, to Kara Swisher's popular podcast. Late last year, he took the main stage at Texas Tribune Festival alongside The Atlantic's Jeffrey Goldberg for a wide-ranging conversation. Howard Dean, the former governor of Vermont who ran for president in 2004, said the Democrats thinking about a potential run are doing exactly what they need to be doing this far out from the nominating contest. "You have to start early because you have to introduce yourself to the people who are going to give you money and the tech people and the grassroots people," Dean said in an interview. The former governor said the late night interviews, while pointed at times, are useful because it allows people to take their measure of you while under some fire, he said. "It's important to see how you do on the big stage." Podcasts, he said, also bolster an image and are helpful to both the candidate and the inner listener. "Ambition bleeds through any attempt to be congenial, and if you don't have that quality of real connection with people, it's going to be a real handicap, and that's going to come out in podcasts," Dean said. "Books, on the other hand, don't add much dimension," he said. "I wouldn't read most of them," Dean said, including his own pre-campaign book, which he acknowledged that a senior aide wrote in a hurry after interviewing the governor. "I don't believe in those books unless you have something to say," he said. The story on voter ID and ICE: do the parties want the policy win or the campaign issue? Republicans want to identify voters. Democrats want to identify immigration and customs enforcement officers. Can they both get what they say they want? That's the question before the Senate as dual-track negotiations continue over funding the Department of Homeland Security and a House-passed bill mandating changes to state election laws. The two have become intertwined as the barely GOP-controlled House and MAGA Republicans in the Senate look for ways to get something out of any potential compromise that may come out of the Homeland Security fight. It's Democrats who have a choice to make between making laws and messaging on the shutdown, while Republicans face the same quandary on voter identification. The quick primer goes like this. After the killings of two activists by Homeland Security agents in Minneapolis last month, the massive public opinion backlash forced the Trump administration to abandon its efforts to brazen out on mass deportations and listen to politically vulnerable Republicans in Congress facing the midterm abyss. That led to administrative moves, personnel changes, and some policy shifts, but also the agreement to allow the agency's funding to be pulled out of a larger budget deal. Isolating the current shutdown into one agency, and a controversial and unpopular one at that, dramatically deleveraged the White House and MAGA members of Congress. With more than 90% of the government funded through the end of September, there are far fewer pain points for the administration to punish Senate Democrats than there were during last fall's Obamacare-themed shutdown. The administration has a lot less fat in the fire, too, because of an extra $75 billion to fund immigration enforcement in President Trump's reconciliation package last year, the GOP gets to keep its top agency priority running while the rest grinds to a halt. But eventually stoppages and disruptions at some combination of the Transportation Security Administration, the Coast Guard, and the Federal Emergency Management Agency will provide sufficient incentives for both sides to make a deal. In the Obamacare shutdown, Senate Democrats had the politically superior posture but lacked secure footing on the legislation. They were trying to bring an unrelated policy issue into a fight over keeping the government open and therefore lost the legislative fight even as they scored political points. This time, the issue and the politics are currently both on the Democrat side, and they might score on both. The shutdown negotiations aren't between the Republican and Democratic senators, but between Senate Democrats and the president and his team. The demand from Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer of New York is lengthy and includes straightforward popular provisions, like requiring agents to show their faces and display their names during public enforcement actions and to use body cameras. But the list goes on to things like requiring agents to get warrants from civilian courts to enter private property in pursuit of a suspected immigrant without legal status instead of using the agency's own administrative judges, forbidding agents from enforcement at sensitive sites like hospitals, schools, courthouses, and polling places, and a ban on racial profiling. The warrants, sensitive sites, and racial profiling are harder sells, including with squishy Republicans who want guardrails and accountability, but not to erect a thicket of permanent restrictions to solve what they believe to be a temporary problem caused by a mix of administrative arrogance and incompetence, and explaining the difference between an Article II court and an Article III court does not make for compelling politics for the public. If Schumer was willing to table the rest and hammer away at the masks and body cameras, which are issues lopsided in the Dems' favor, those things actually might happen. But that would require Senate Democrats to stick together, not so much against Trump, which is the easy part, but against their own activist voters. There are many Democrats who think that funding the agency at all, let alone without the full slate of restrictions, would be a betrayal. Getting enough Senate Democrats to take the leap together so that individual members don't get singled out will be no easy task, especially when many in the party also have the worse the better mindset here. Why should Democrats help bail Republicans out of a problem that's hurting the GOP in the midterms, the thinking goes, when the blue team can just capitalize on the pain, win back the Senate, and pass whatever restrictions they want later? That's how Republicans walked away from a good deal on immigration in 2024. It worked politically to deprive Democrats of a win in an election year on a key issue, and the actual benefits of having a more cogent immigration policy. Of course, the other part, the great imaginary legislation of the future, never arrived, womp womp. But given the president's obvious focus on midterms and his new understanding of how his own poor ratings redound to the disadvantage of his party, and therefore his own chances of avoiding impeachment in a very hostile Congress for his final 2 years in office, suggests he might be willing to make a deal. That's certainly what the MAGA members of Congress are bracing for. As Trump is negotiating with Senate Democrats, hardliners in the House and Senate are negotiating with their own leaders about what they would want in return for Trump making them walk the plank on an immigration enforcement deal. House Republicans tried and failed to make their voter ID legislation part of the spending package, but over on the Senate side, the game continues. The Republicans have a similar challenge here. Part of their voting proposal is very popular and very hard for Democrats to refuse if plainly offered. There are few issues with as much support across every demographic and partisan line as requiring voters to show photo ID. And if that's all their bill did, it would be hard for Democrats to stop. But the list of demands goes on to require registrants to provide proof of citizenship, which is a bit of a reach since it would basically mean all registrations would have to be done in person. Then it takes the next step of dictating how and how often states must purge their voter rolls, which really starts to smack of federal overreach. Elections are state business, and as Republicans pointed out when the Biden-era Democrats tried a federal takeover of elections, centralizing authority over elections in Washington isn't just against the spirit of the Constitution, it carries risks. It's one thing to say which voters are eligible to participate in federal elections, but quite another to dictate how the states will administer them. Plus, the same polls that show voter ID to be so popular show similar enthusiasm for mail voting and other conveniences that Republicans are trying to stop. But that all assumes that Republicans would rather get something done on elections more than they would like to have the opportunity to play sore losers this fall and take back up the bloody shirt of rigged elections. That one plays like gangbusters with the GOP base, a base that would likely be none too pleased to see compromise on an issue that has become at least equal in the minds of MAGA activists to the immigration crackdown. But if Republicans could scale back their demands to just voter identification and Democrats to identifying immigration agents and adding body cameras, even in this toxic, dysfunctional Congress, it's not impossible to see a deal coming together. But that would, of course, mean enough people in both parties determining that they would rather have a modest policy win than the chance to take political advantage of the dysfunction they're helping to create. So maybe don't hold your breath. The story is The Hill's Morning Report, U.S. meets Iran in search of historic deal. In today's issue, Jesse Jackson dies at 84. Next round of Iran nuclear talks, FBI won't share evidence in Preddy investigation, AOC stumbles on foreign policy. U.S. and Iranian officials are set to meet for a second round of talks on Iran's nuclear program today, as the Trump administration strives for a deal that has so far proved elusive. Tuesday's talks are taking place in Geneva, Switzerland. The U.S. delegation is led by President Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, and his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, both of whom have been heavily involved in peacemaking efforts in various conflicts, including between Israel and Hamas and Gaza. Representatives from the two countries met earlier this month for indirect talks in Oman to try to reach a diplomatic solution on Iranian nuclear developments. After the meeting, both sides described those discussions as productive and indicated they would plan to meet again. The U.S. and Iran took part in nuclear talks last year, but Iran pulled out of those discussions after Israel launched airstrikes targeting Tehran's nuclear facilities and military sites in June. The U.S. subsequently launched its own strikes against three Iranian nuclear sites days later. Tensions have been rising between the U.S. and the Middle Eastern nation in recent months, especially amid nationwide protests that the Iranian regime cracked down on harshly, resulting in thousands killed. The Trump administration ultimately held off on striking Iran while the protests were at their peak, but it has built up its military assets in the region in preparation for a possible attack. Iranian naval forces began military exercises in the Strait of Hormuz on Monday, on the eve of the planned discussions in a show of strength. The exercises included rehearsing scenarios to respond to security threats in the area, but Trump hasn't taken diplomacy off the table and is still in search of a breakthrough deal to further cement his legacy on foreign policy, which has been a major focus throughout his second term. The president's decision to hold off on strikes so far suggests he sees at least some path to a deal, even if it's a difficult one. Witkoff and Kushner on Tuesday are also expected to participate in a separate set of talks between Russian and Ukrainian officials as part of the ongoing push to bring an end to the war between those two countries. The administration has sought to portray Trump as a global peacemaker, bringing an end to various conflicts around the world, though ending the Russian war has proven the most challenging yet. Settling tensions around Iran's nuclear program would be a major achievement to add to the president's global peacemaking efforts, but officials have recognized the hurdles facing them. These people make policy decisions on the basis of pure theology, Secretary of State Marco Rubio said of Iran during a trip to Hungary on Monday. That's how they make their decisions, so it's hard to do a deal with Iran. We've always said it's hard, but we're going to try. Rubio's comments come as he has been taking part in a multi-day trip that included a visit to the Munich Security Conference in Germany over the weekend. He struck a much more conciliatory tone toward the U.S.'s European allies than Vice President Vance did at last year's conference, seeking to reassure Europe the U.S. wants to work together on security issues. CBS News reported Trump told Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu during a meeting in December that the U.S. would support another round of Israeli strikes on Iran if negotiations fail. Senior figures in the military and intelligence communities have now started to consider backing another round of strikes, the outlet reported following Trump and Netanyahu's meeting in Washington last week. Smart take with Blake Berman. Ever wanted to pose a question to a lawmaker? Viewer's Voice is a new segment on The Hill with Blake Berman on News Nation, airing weeknights at 6 p.m. ET. The segment debuts tomorrow with Representative Rich McCormick, Republican of Georgia. The segment puts voter questions directly to members of Congress about their issues shaping their lives. This is built on a simple principle. The U.S. government represents all Americans, and it has to work for you. Send us a question you want to ask Congress based on the issues most important to you. Topics can include the issues on your mind, including the shutdown of the Department of Homeland Security, the government's latest efforts on affordability, or anything else that matters to you. Please include your name and city-state and specify if you do not want your name used on air. We encourage you to pose your question in a video and send along to us. We'll ask a number of your questions directly to lawmakers during our Viewer's Voice segment this week. Submit your questions in an email to viewersvoice@newsnationnow.com. Three things to know today. Trump said he's directing federal officials to assist in cleanup efforts concerning the wastewater spill in the Potomac River. He blamed state and local officials for the breach, a claim that a spokesperson for Maryland Governor Wes Moore, Democrat, rejected. Anderson Cooper plans to leave CBS's 60 Minutes, which he has contributed to for nearly 20 years, saying in a statement he wants to spend more time with his family. He's expected to stay through the end of the current season in May and continue with his CNN show. The Hill event, Top Women in Policy, join Senator Patty Murray, Democrat of Washington, Representative Ashley Hinson, Republican of Iowa, and top strategists on March 4 to spotlight the women driving the 119th Congress from AI to the economy, meet the women navigating the new political map. Leading the day, farewell, the Reverend Jesse Jackson, a longtime civil rights leader who ran two prominent campaigns for the Democratic nomination for president in the 1980s, has died at the age of 84. Jackson's family announced his death in a statement early Tuesday morning, saying he died surrounded by family. Jackson had been battling the neurodegenerative disorder, progressive supranuclear palsy, or PSP. Our father was a servant leader, not only to our family, but to the oppressed, the voiceless, and the overlooked around the world, the Jackson family said. His unwavering belief in justice, equality, and love uplifted millions, and we ask you to honor his memory by continuing the fight for the values he lived by, the statement continued. An outpouring of condolences for Jackson are expected throughout the day. Tuesday, a protege of the late Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., Jackson gained national attention in the 1960s when he was a member of the Greenville Eight, who tried to desegregate a public library in South Carolina. He helped lead the Southern Christian Leadership Conference's Operation Breadbasket, a program focused on improving the lives of black people economically. Jackson later formed his own civil rights organization that became known as the Rainbow Push Coalition, based in Chicago. He entered the world of politics more directly when he launched what had been considered a long-shot presidential campaign in 1984 oppose former President Reagan's re-election bid. Jackson outperformed expectations and became a serious candidate, ultimately coming in third for the Democratic nomination behind former Vice President Walter Mondale. He tried again for the nomination in 1988, placing second behind then Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis. Jackson did win election in 1990 to become one of Washington, D.C.'s first shadow senators. He received the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2000 from then-President Clinton. Jackson continued his activism in his later years despite PSP affecting his ability to move and speak, appearing at protests following the killing of George Floyd in 2020 and more recently at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago in 2024. Epstein fallout. Hyatt Hotels Corporation Executive Chair Tom Pritzker has become the latest public figure to face blowback over his ties to Jeffrey Epstein, announcing Monday that he would resign from his role. Pritzker, who is Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker's Democrat cousin, revealed his decision in a letter to the company's board after recently disclosed files showed he kept in close touch with the disgraced financier years after Epstein pleaded guilty to soliciting prostitution from a minor. Tom Pritzker, who has served as the chair since 2004, hasn't been personally accused of wrongdoing, but did communicate with Epstein about his interactions with women. "I exercised terrible judgment in maintaining contact with them, and there is no excuse for failing to distance myself sooner," Pritzker wrote in the letter. He is the latest major figure to step back from a position over revelations from the Epstein files, joining others such as Wall Street lawyer Kathy Ruemmler, corporate attorney Brad Karp, and Hollywood mogul Casey Wasserman, among others. Death penalty threat. The president warned Nancy Guthrie's kidnappers would face the death penalty if the mother of Today Show anchor Savannah Guthrie is found dead. Trump told the New York Post in a phone interview the consequences would be the most severe if the kidnappers kill Nancy Guthrie, responding to a question about whether the Department of Justice, or DOJ, would seek the death penalty. The FBI is searching for a possible suspect seen on Guthrie's doorbell camera, described as standing between 5'9" and 5'10", with an average build and seen wearing dark gloves, sweatpants, and a jacket. Savannah Guthrie said in a video post on Sunday that the family is still clinging to hope that her mother is still alive 2 weeks after her disappearance, and it is never too late to do the right thing, and we are here. We believe, and we believe in the essential goodness of every human being, she said in a video addressed to anyone who might know where her mother is. Anthropic ties. The Pentagon is reviewing its association with the AI company Anthropic over the terms of use of its AI product Claude. The Department of Defense and Anthropic have held discussions for months about the military's terms of use for Claude, but Axios reported officials are now weighing whether to cut ties and label the company a supply chain risk. Claude was apparently used during the U.S. operation to capture former Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro last month through Anthropic's partnership with Palantir, stoking tensions with the Pentagon. Anthropic has denied reaching out to the Department of Palantir, which has extensive military contracts about the raid. Axios reported Anthropic is prepared to loosen its terms of service, but wants to ensure its tools aren't used to develop weaponry that fires without human involvement, and its products aren't used for mass surveillance on Americans. Chief Pentagon spokesperson Sean Barnell told The Hill that partnership's review is about guaranteeing the country's security. "Our nation requires that our partners be willing to help our warfighters win in any fight. Ultimately, this is about our troops and the safety of the American people," he said. No evidence sharing. The FBI has formally decided not to share any information about its investigation into the death of Alex Preddy with Minnesota officials, isolating the federal and state probes into the ICU nurse's death. Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, or BCA, Superintendent Drew Evans said in a statement Monday that the FBI notified the agency it won't provide access to any information or evidence it has gathered related to Preddy's death last month at the hands of federal immigration officers. While this lack of cooperation is concerning and unprecedented, the BCA is committed to thorough, independent, and transparent investigations of these incidents, even if hampered by a lack of access to key information and evidence, Evans said, adding that BCA will continue to pursue all legal avenues to gain access to information. The decision doesn't come as significant surprise, as the FBI had indicated it wouldn't coordinate with BCA on the investigation into the death of Renee Good earlier in January. But it's a setback in relations between the federal government and state officials, with tensions otherwise cooling as immigration agents withdraw from Minnesota. White House Border Czar Tom Homan said Sunday a small security force would remain in the state for a short period of time to ensure agreements reached with local and state law enforcement remain in place. Multiple investigations are ongoing into Preddy's death, including one from the DOJ's Civil Rights Division, though Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche cast doubt on its significance. In the where and when, the president will participate in ambassador credentialing at 2 p.m., he will participate in policy meetings at 4 p.m. and 5 p.m. The House will convene at 11 a.m. for a pro forma session. The Senate will meet at 6:30 p.m. for a pro forma. Zoom in, AOC stumbles. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Democrat of New York, received a mixed response to her appearance at the Munich Security Conference, putting a possible vulnerability on display despite her status as a rising star in the Democratic Party. Ocasio-Cortez was one of the potential 2028 presidential contenders who visited the conference last week, calling on international leaders to fight for the working class and slamming the Trump administration's moves on foreign policy. But some parts of her remarks received criticism and raised questions about her foreign policy prowess. The Hill's Julia Mueller reports, the Congresswoman stumbled on a question about whether the U.S. should commit to sending troops to defend Taiwan if China invades, and on another occasion she said Venezuela is below the equator, though it's entirely on the north in the northern hemisphere. Doubts about her comfortability on the topic are receiving attention as Ocasio-Cortez is considered a top possible candidate for the Democratic presidential nomination in 2028. She's also been floated as a possible candidate for Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer's Democrat of New York Senate seat, regardless of whether Schumer decides to run for another term. Trump chimed in on Ocasio-Cortez's struggles, telling reporters on Air Force One on Monday that it wasn't a good look for the country. Some Democrats said her stumble signaled she's not ready for higher office, while others said the criticism of her shows her strength. She sought to refocus the narrative on her message during her appearance at the conference, which she said is being overshadowed by speculation about her future ambitions. This reporter came up to me and was like, is Munich the new New Hampshire? And I cannot say enough how out of touch and missing the point generally that is, she said in an interview with the New York Times. Global democracies are on fire the world over, and established parties are falling to right-wing populist movements. Russian denial. Russia has denied five European countries' accusation that former Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny was killed in 2024 with a lethal toxin. Naturally, we do not accept such accusations. We disagree with them. We consider them biased and not based on anything, and we strongly reject them, Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov told reporters. Navalny was serving a 19-year prison sentence after being convicted of extremism charges when he died in custody in 2024. A longtime sharp critic of Russian President Vladimir Putin, Navalny had denounced his sentence as politically motivated, as had many Western countries. Monday marked the 2-year anniversary of his death. Russia said Navalny died of natural causes, but the foreign ministers of the United Kingdom, Sweden, France, Germany, and the Netherlands said Saturday that analysis of samples from Navalny show he was poisoned with epibetidine, a toxin found in poisoned dart frogs in South America. They said the poison isn't found naturally in Russia, Rubio said Sunday that the U.S. doesn't have any reason to question the European countries finding calling it troubling. Reverse, a federal judge ordered the National Park Service to restore exhibits about slavery at Independence National Historical Park in Philadelphia, finding the administration's removal of them was likely unlawful. The judge invoked the dystopian novel 1984 in her ruling. And finally, the conservationist legacy of former President Theodore Roosevelt is back on display as his descendants are calling on lawmakers to protect public lands in Minnesota. The descendants of the 26th president wrote a letter to senators obtained by the New York Times earlier this month, calling on them to oppose a resolution overturning a Biden administration decision to prevent mining in a wilderness area near the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. The House passed the resolution last month, sending it to the Senate for consideration. Roosevelt established a reputation during his two terms as president as a major advocate of conservation efforts, pushing to ensure natural resources were used responsibly. While serving as president, he established more than 230 million acres of public lands, created the U.S. Forest Service, and helped found multiple national parks. More national parks are named in his honor than any other president. The story, what to know about the disastrous Potomac sewage spill. Nearly a month after a wastewater spill into the Potomac River began, recovery efforts are ongoing. The spillage, which resulted from a section of the Potomac Interceptor sewer line, collapsed last month, resulting in an overflow of roughly 243 million gallons of wastewater as of February 6, according to D.C. Water. Although public health officials have said the spillage did not impact drinking water quality, residents are still encouraged to avoid contact with the Potomac River. President Trump weighed in on the matter in a Truth Social post Monday, blaming local and state Democratic officials in Maryland and saying he would direct federal efforts to assist in the operation. Here's what to know. When did the spill begin? On January 19, a section of the Potomac Interceptor along the Clara Barton Parkway in Montgomery County, Maryland, collapsed. The D.C. Department of Energy and Environment, or DOEE, says the interceptor carries up to 60 million gallons of wastewater daily from Virginia and Maryland to Blue Plains Advanced Wastewater Treatment Plant on the banks of the Potomac in southwest Washington. The collapse resulted in a significant quantity of untreated sewage flowing into the Potomac, according to the DOEE. D.C. Water, a local water utility, said on February 6 that roughly 194 million gallons overflowed from the collapse site in the first 5 days after the incident, with about 49 million gallons overflowing in the time since. The utility noted that the estimated peak discharge of wastewater, roughly 40 million gallons per day, accounts for about 2% of the Potomac's total flow during the period. But the Potomac Riverkeeper Network, or PRKN, a local environmental advocacy group, estimated on February 5 that the collapse resulted in roughly 300 million gallons discharged into the Potomac. To that point, Betsy Nicholas, the president of the PRKN, told The Hill on Monday that estimate was based on data from D.C. Water regarding how much wastewater flows through the pipe daily. Nicholas said Dean Najokas, the Potomac Riverkeeper, requested data that D.C. Water has from software that measures how much water flows through the pipe daily. D.C. Water turned down his request, though.